João Penedonis and Pedro Vieira for inviting me, for asking me to give this colloquium, and in fact for asking me to visit. So it's a real treat to be here at Perimeter, and there are, I think, very few places who pamper the visitors the way you do so that we can focus on science. So this colloquium, my talk, is meant as a complement to this workshop that is going on now. So what is this bootstrap thing? So how does that work? So this thing refers to really trying to lift yourself by your own bootstraps. And I was actually convinced that this thing, the first person who tried this was Baron Münchhausen. But I learned that that's not true. Actually, what he did was to lift himself and his horse by pulling by his hair, not by bootstraps. So what we, you know, in our version of the story, you know, we have, so our, in our version of the story, Baron Münchhausen is played by Professor Polyakov, and the mud out of which we are trying to pull ourselves is the space of CFT data, and the hair by which we pull is called conformal block decomposition. So one of my goals is to try to explain you what this whole thing means. And but first, I'd like to begin to talk about something more elementary. So my subject today is conformal invariance. But actually, you know, before you start speaking about conformal invariance, you have to speak about scale invariance. And the simplest example of scale invariance in physics is ferromagnetism. So let's do that. So let's take a ferromagnet. And you know, let's take, for instance, a 3D Ising model, if you wish. So we're going to use this example often in this talk. And so there is an experimentalist who tunes the temperature to be close to the critical temperature. And we look at this local magnetization, M of X, this local magnetization field. So then, first, we sit at a temperature which is slightly above the critical temperature. So what do we see? We see that the average value of the local magnetization is zero. So we look at the two-point function correlation of this magnetization, and we see that it, at short distances, it behaves like a power, 1 over x to the 2 delta, and at large distances, it decays like an exponential. So that's what you see. But then you go, you fine-tune the temperature even more, and you go to the critical point, to the critical temperature, and at this point, you see that this parameter x of t, which is in the exponential, which is called the correlation length, diverges, and the two-point function of the magnetization becomes a pure power. So that when you rescale, when you send x to lambda x, this thing just scales by a constant factor. So this is scale invariance. So you see, scale invariance is a very natural thing which appears when you go to a critical point. Now, what about conformal invariance? Well, conformal invariance is more mysterious. So it appears also as a critical point together with scale invariance, but it appears as a bonus. So it turns out that there is this other transformation. I don't know why my slides don't work. So there is this other transformation, which is, you see, it's not a linear transformation like scale transformation or a rotation. It's a quadratic transformation in X. This is called a conformal transformation. And the characteristic property of this transformation is that it preserves the orthogonality of conformal, of coordinate grid. So locally, it looks like a dilatation. And the statement is that generically, at a critical point, this transformation is also going to be a symmetry of your theory. So why? Why is this extra symmetry? And perhaps somewhat surprisingly, this is not well understood. So this is not completely understood. In particular, the puzzle is that it's generically true, but it's not always true. So there are some counterexamples, even physically interesting counterexamples of critical points which don't have this. But generically, this is true, so it makes a lot of sense to focus on this case. So it makes sense to do this because you make a small sacrifice in generality, but you gain a huge lot in constraining power. So this is just one example how conformal symmetry helps you a lot. For instance, let's look at the three-point correlation function. So what I mean by that is that let's look at the same example as before, at the three-dimensional Ising model. So I introduced already, I introduced one field in this Ising model, the magnetization field, and now I introduce a second field, the energy density field, epsilon of x. So if you look at the two-point function, at the two-point correlation function of epsilon of x, then this thing scales, so by scale invariance at the critical point, it scales like 1 over x to the delta. And this parameter delta is the only free parameter here, so you can determine it by a variety of methods. You can determine it by doing experiments at the critical point. You can do numerical simulations of the three-dimensional Ising model, determine this parameter, or you can actually compute it theoretically, and it's pretty well known in three dimensions. It's known to three significant digits. But let us now look at the three-point correlation function. So that's where the interesting thing starts. So the three-point correlation function, it's a very important physical observable, so it basically measures for you the deviations from Gaussianity in the fluctuations of the energy in your model. So it's important to know this quantity, and here the scale invariance is not much of a help for you. So by scale invariance, you know that this three-point correlation function, it basically is a sum of terms which should scale, which should have a correct dimension when you rescale all three points, x and y, okay, here's zero, by the same power of lambda. So you can write infinitely many terms which have the right transformation property under this scale transformation. So you don't seem to have much of constraining power, but, and here comes the magic of conformal invariance. So the conformal invariance tells you that out of all this infinite number of terms, only one is going to survive. So actually it tells you that this three-point correlation function is going to be the totally symmetric product of powers, x minus 1 to the delta, x to the delta, y to the delta. So this formula, which was first derived by Poliakov in 1970, in a certain sense, it was the first non-trivial result about conformal invariance, and you could say that it gave rise really to conformal field theory as a subject, gave birth. All right, so this talk is, so the focus of this talk is going to be on conformal field theories in three and higher dimensions, but I put just one slide to say something about two-dimensional conformal field theories, just because it has been just such an amazing success story. And it has been a success story because there are some special things about two dimensions. So in two dimensions, this conformal symmetry is actually infinite dimensional. So in addition to this quadratic conformal transformation which I talked about, there is all the powers of Z. So if you go to the complex coordinates, then all the powers of Z become conformal transformations. So as a result, the constraining power of conformal symmetry is actually is overwhelming. So you can, in particular, you have like a huge list of exactly solvable models, starting, for instance, with the 2D Ising model, which is exactly solvable, while the 3D Ising model is not exactly solvable, has not been solved exactly. And these models, they play a big role in statistical mechanics, and really have been lots of applications. And another thing which played a big role in the development of this subject is that it's intimately connected to string theory. So this two-dimensional conformal field theory, it computes for you scattering amplitudes in perturbative world sheet string theory. So this also contributed to the development of the field. So it's there, this two-dimensional CFT is there. It's well understood in a sense. So it's kind of a guiding star for us, and it tells us what level of perfection you should aim for in high-dimensional CFTs. And why should we think about high-dimensional CFTs? Well, there are several reasons, several important physical reasons to think about high-dimensional CFTs, so I'm going to talk about that now. So there is the subject of quantum criticality. Then there is a connection with problem of quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter background, as we will see. And finally, there is something which I mostly worked on myself, is the applications of the conformal field theories to hierarchy problems in particle physics. So what is this quantum criticality? So you look at the condensed matter system, not at finite temperature, but at zero temperature. So, and your control parameters, so before the temperature was a control parameter in the Ising model problem, and here the control parameters are some parameters on which your Hamiltonian depends. So you try to go to the critical point, not by adjusting the temperature, but by adjusting these parameters of the Hamiltonian. So that's the only change. And let's consider this one example, just one example. It's an isotropic ferromagnet in two dimensions. So you take an anti-ferromagnet, and it's an isotropic, so there are two kinds of couplings, two kinds of anti-ferromagnetic couplings. There is one coupling J, and then there is another coupling which is reduced to enhance as J over lambda. So there are two kinds of couplings, and this parameter lambda is the parameter of your Hamiltonian which you vary. So if this parameter is small, then this antiferromagnet is in what is called Néel phase. So it means that all the spins are alternating up, down, up, down, up, down. In this case, there is an order parameter, Néel order parameter. And if, on the other hand, this parameter lambda is large, then these links become much weaker than the horizontal links, and you go to this phase which is called dimer phase. So you have spins coupled pairwise, but they don't talk much. These dimers don't talk much to each other. And between these two phases, there is a quantum phase transition. So it's a certain value of lambda. It's a second order transition because in one case there is an order parameter, this Néel ordering. And it turns out that this, so you have a 2D antiferromagnet, but this phase transition turns out to be, again, our old friend, three-dimensional Ising model universality class. So this is a very simple, the simplest maybe example of quantum phase transition. But it's also shows the main feature of these transitions. So it seems it's generically true, it's generally true, that if you take a d-dimensional quantum system at zero temperature, then it's equivalent to a d plus one dimensional quantum field theory in the continuum limit. And so that's what you have seen here. You had a two-dimensional antiferromagnet, but at the critical point, it was described by a three-dimensional Ising model. So what this means is that if you want to understand this quantum criticality, and you do want to understand this quantum criticality because it plays an important role in condensed matter physics, and there are many more complicated examples where we don't know what the universality class, what is the theory which describes the critical point is. And there are examples involving strongly correlated fermions, and those are believed to play a role in understanding high TC superconductivity and so on. So if you really want to understand this quantum critical points, then what do you have to have? You have to have an access to a database, if you wish, of three or high dimensional conformal field theories, so that you could see, you know, you could look at what the critical exponents are, you can possibly match them to experiments, and you could fix what the universality class is. And you also have to have an access to such CFTs having fermionic excitations if you want to work with strongly correlated electrons. And this is important, so this is an important point, because for some bosonic systems, you could just do a numerical simulation and you could say, well, I don't worry about the fact that I cannot determine these critical exponents theoretically. I just do a numerical simulation and I'm going to extract them from numerics. But it's very difficult to simulate systems with fermions because of fermion signs. And so you need input from theory. So that's really the reason that why you need input from theory. So this is a very important problem, and now is probably the right moment to introduce, to usher in the ADS-CFT. So ADS-CFT, and as probably everyone in the audience knows, it's a particular construction, a very remarkable construction, which tells you that, which proposes to raise the dimension by one unit yet again. So we already raised it in quantum criticality. We went to a deep d-dimensional CFT. And now we raise it yet again. So we say that we introduced this anti-de Sitter space, a d plus one dimensional space. And we say that a theory of gravity plus some other fields in anti-de Sitter space is going to be dual. Is going to provide a description for a conformal field theory on the boundary of this space. So that's the statement. So this statement, it has originally been introduced for n equal 4 super Young Mills for a very particular maximally supersymmetric field theory, conformal field theory in four dimensions. But, you know, the way we understand it now is that it's really much, much more general. So it's something that you can view as, in a sense, a CFT-generating machine. So what you do is that you take anti-de Sitter space, you throw in essentially any field content you like, always including gravity. You turn the handle, and it generates for you correlators on the boundary, which satisfies very many consistency conditions of conformal field theory automatically. I am going to speak about that. So this is very, very powerful. So this has many advantages. So the first advantage of this construction is that it's flexibility. It's really, you can throw in whatever fields you want in the bulk. You can construct theories with fermionic excitations by throwing direct fermions in the bulk. Bosonic excitations is basically no difference. And, you know, this is important because if we want to have an access to a large database of CFTs, as I said. And another very important advantage of this construction is that it tells you how to put the theory at finite temperature. So it turns out that in this framework, if you want to study things at finite temperature, all you have to do is to put, to modify your gravitational background. Instead of taking this ADS space, you put a black hole in this space, and the Hawking temperature of this black hole has to be equal to the temperature that you want to study. So this is, you know, if you do this, you can study transfer properties at finite temperature backgrounds, and this is really very, very powerful, and this would be very difficult, like in a generic CFT without ADS, that would be a very difficult problem to solve. Actually, it's not known how to solve it in generality. Here, you can do this. Well, at the same time, there are also certain limitations of this construction, and I'll just mention one limitation, actually two limitations. So one limitation that I'd like to mention is something which you can call factorization of operator dimension. So what does this mean physically? Well, you take two operators of your CFT, you put them next to each other, and then you look at these two operators from very, very far away. So when you look at them from far away, you can think of them as a local, as some local excitation of your theory. So it's going to react, it's going to be probed by this faraway observer as a local operator of the theory. So you can ask, what's the dimension of this operator? It turns out that in theories based on ADS, the dimension of this fused, you can say, operator is always supposed to be very close to the sum of the dimensions of the two operators that you started with. So essentially, this means that faraway probes, so that these two operators are one and the two, they interact with faraway probes independently. They don't talk to each other, essentially. Put another way, this means that these theories, the fluctuation in these theories, are very nearly Gaussian. Well, this factorization property of operator dimensions, it's not always true. Let's look again at the 3D Ising model, what happens there. So there are these two fields, M and epsilon, and it turns out that when you fuse two fields, M and M, fuse two magnetization fields, you get precisely this energy density field epsilon, and these two dimensions, they are known, okay, they are known numerically, but they are known, and the dimension of M is very close to 1/2, it's essentially 0.52, and the dimension of epsilon, as I say, it's approximately 1.4. So as you can see, there is an order one deficit in the operator dimensions. So you see that the delta epsilon is actually close to 3 times delta m, not 2 times delta m. So this is a very non-Gaussian phenomenon. And, you know, if you take this at face value, you conclude that not every CFT is supposed to have an ADS description. So there are some CFTs out there that do not have a useful ADS description. I don't expect a useful dual. Well, in 4 dimensions, there is no Ising criticality point. I'm saying there are theories which are clearly, you know, far beyond any sharp or fuzzy line. They're so far away that the line becomes sharp. So here I'm going to discuss this other issue, which is very, which is also very interesting. So this is an issue about the fact that the theory of gravity in anti-de-Sitter space or in any high-dimensional space is actually not a well-defined by itself, and not well-defined, not a UV-complete, as we say, in quantum mechanical system, so, as we know. So what do you do about that? Well, there are several points of view on this subject. I don't want to claim that there is a consensus. So there are some people who would say that what you have to do is you have to look for UV-completion for this theory of gravity. For instance, in terms of string theory, as it happens for n equal 4 super Young-Mills. And then there are other people, and I side with them, which think that this would be too restrictive, because we don't want to subscribe to one particular UV completion mechanism. What would be better to do, like as a first step, is to think of this theory of gravity as an effective field theory, in the sense that we understand, we think we understand what an effective field theory is, around the ADS background. So this is going to be an effective field theory valid up to some high, sufficiently high energy cutoff, let's say Planck scale, maybe somewhat lower than the Planck scale. And in order for this effective field theory to have sense, to make sense, there is one important condition, that you have to assume that this Planck scale is much larger than the curvature radius of the ADS space. Otherwise, the classical geometry loses any meaning. So that's like one model-independent condition that you have to assume. Well, if you assume this, fine. But then you have to face to the fact that the theory on the boundary that you define via this construction is not going to be a bona fide CFT. So it's going to be something else. So what is it going to be? Well, it seems natural to introduce this concept, which is called effective conformal field theory. So this effective conformal field theory, it's a theory which describes operators not of arbitrary dimensions, but only up to some very high critical dimension, which is related to the hierarchy between M Planck and the curvature radius. So this critical dimension can be very much bigger than one. And then you say that there should be a notion of decoupling in conformal field theory in the same sense as there's a notion of decoupling in usual effective field theory. Well, not in the same sense, but like in a similar, in a more or less similar sense. So in this particular case for ADS theories, this is basically one-to-one correspondence between these two decouplings, but you could try to argue that this decoupling, this concept of effective CFT, is actually more general. It has something, it has some meaning without even necessarily an ADS interpretation. So if you do this, if you buy this, then you get an important insight. What you conclude is that you have a correspondence between two problems. One problem is a problem of UV completing a theory of gravity in an anti-de Sitter background. Another problem is the problem of completing an effective CFT. So you reduced something which is potentially not so easy to well define, a problem of quantum gravity in ADS, to something which is potentially easier to define, a problem about normal conformal field theories in flat space. So I'll just flash two possible applications of what this point of view can do for you. So the first application is that, you know, for this thing to make sense, you should be able to translate, you know, if one day you manage to UV complete, if you manage to complete your CFT, you want to go back to the quantum gravity and you want to be able to read off observables of quantum gravity from observables of CFT. Can you do this? Well, it turns out that there is a neat way to do this. So one of the observables of quantum gravity would be, for instance, a graviton scattering amplitude. And it turns out that in order, if you want to extract the scattering amplitude, what you need to do is to take a particular limit of a CFT correlation function, and in which it's going to be to have a singularity, and you know, from the strength of the singularity, you will extract, from the residue of the singularity, you will extract scattering amplitude for the gravitons. So this works. Another example is, actually, it's not even, so the first example is kind of a test that the whole thing makes sense. The second example is actually not just a test. It's it's a step forward. So it's an application. So it's an example how we can learn something about the theory of quantum gravity using this correspondence. So the question is, can we get constraints on the quantum theory of gravity by knowing that a boundary CFT can be UV completed? Well, what is a, you know, what would be a sharp question? So okay, here I have a different representation of ADS space. So a very minimum of any theory of quantum gravity that you may ask of any theory of quantum gravity is the existence of gravitons. That would be the bare minimum. And in this interpretation, in this picture, then these gravitons are described by stress tensor in the boundary in the CFT, by the stress tensor operator. So if you want to know, so we would like to know if there is anything else in the theory apart from the gravitons. No, that would be a non-trivial thing to say. And if there is something, then where does it live? So what one can show, what it turns out that one can show in a particular but a very general situation, that one can show that the CFT, the consistency of CFT, demands that it should have not just a stress tensor operator. It should have more stuff. And you can actually get a precise handle on where this stuff is, where the dimension of, so in technical language, what the dimension of this operator is. And then when you go back and you interpret it, you get a bound on the mass of the quantum black holes, of small quantum black holes, which live in this ADS space. You get a universal bound for the mass of these black holes. It should be valid for any theory of quantum gravity in ADS space. Okay, this has been done by Simon Hellerman in one particular case, but this philosophy should really apply and should be pursued and probably will give rise to more results of this kind. All right. So I'm more or less in the middle of my talk. So I already talked about two reasons why we should think about high-dimensional CFTs. And now, so my last reason, which is actually the dearest to my heart, is the question of hierarchies in particle physics. So let me talk about that. So the application, the idea would be to look for, is there a place, is there a reason, is there a meaning to try to have CFTs in beyond the standard model of particle physics. But first, let us look at the standard model itself. So if you look at the standard model itself, you can ask, well, is the standard model of particle physics a CFT? Well, you know, the standard model contains massive particles. We know this. And in particular, it contains several very massive particles, like the W boson, the Z boson, the top quark, and possibly the Higgs boson. So they have masses of the order of hundreds of GeV. And the masses of these particles, they set a length scale in the standard model. And, you know, if the theory has a length scale, this theory is not scale invariant. It's not even scale invariant, let alone to be conformal invariant. So what you conclude from this is that standard model is not a CFT. Not a CFT. But if you go to high energies, if you go to energies much higher than the masses of these particles, like, for instance, this can happen at the LHC, then you can say that approximately standard model is a CFT. It's a very boring CFT because it's essentially a free theory which is perturbed by slowly running couplings, big couplings, gauge couplings, and Yukawa couplings. It's not a very particularly interesting theory, but it's a CFT. It's a CFT. So, okay, but to follow my logical line, I have to at this point to explain, you know, to draw a dividing line between two types of CFTs. You know, something that I did not have to do in condensed matter physics, but something that we like to do in particle physics. So I'd like to distinguish two types of CFTs. The first type is something that you can call a stable CFT, or more specifically, it's a stable infrared fixed point over a normalization group flow. So what this means is that you have a certain basis of attraction in your space of Hamiltonians, if you wish, microscopic Hamiltonians, such that if you start from anywhere in this space, you're going to flow in the normalization group sense to this fixed point, to the CFT. That would be something that you would call a stable infrared behavior. A second type, which is actually more generic, is an unstable infrared fixed point. So what this means is that in the space of couplings, in the space of Hamiltonians that you can consider, the fixed point, the critical point is not a universal attractor. So there are some directions which are attractive, and then there are some directions which are repulsive. That would be not a stable infrared fixed point. And actually, there is a nice correspondence between you can formulate sharply the existence, the question about existence of these repulsive directions. You can reformulate in terms of question about dimensions of operators in your CFT, in your fixed point. So you can just look at the fixed point itself, and you can say if it's going to be an attractive, a stable or unstable infrared fixed point. So there, you should look at the scalar operators at this fixed point, and you should ask whether there are any scalar operators which have dimension less than d. That would be the thing to ask. Well, actually, more precisely, you can classify your scalars according how do they transform under the global symmetry groups, if your CFT has a symmetry group. And, you know, the particularly dangerous scalars are the ones which are singlets under all global symmetry groups of your CFT. So these are really repulsive directions, genuinely repulsive directions that you cannot control. So, the point that is very relevant to particle physics and not so much relevant to condensed matter physics is that life in such a fixed point is possible only if there exists an experimentalist who is going to fine-tune, to adjust the control knobs, like in our first example, so that it will set you exactly on this attractive trajectory, not an inch above and not an inch below, so that you will be able to flow to the fixed point. There has to be someone who is going to do this for you. And for example, if you take our favorite example, Ising model, then in the Ising model there is one operator which is a singlet scalar operator, singlet under the global symmetry of the Ising model, which is a Z2 symmetry, which reverses the sign of magnetization. So magnetization is not such an operator, but this energy density operator, which has a dimension 1.4, it's less than 3, than the dimension of the field theory. And so this means that if you want to reach this fixed point, you need to adjust some variable, and we adjust the temperature. So this makes sense. This correspondence makes sense. Okay. So that was a general classification, and now you can look at the standard model, and you realize that the standard model has precisely such a dangerous repulsive operator. This operator is the Higgs mass, the Higgs operator squared, which has dimension 2, which is less than 4. So what this means is that standard model as a CFT is unstable. Well, this is puzzling because, you know, you would want to believe that there's no experimentalist up there who turns the knobs and makes us live where we live. So we take it as a hint. So we take it as a hint that so this is called a hierarchy problem, this particular phenomenon, and we take it as a hint that there should be something beyond the standard model at the TV scale, at the scale of the LHC experiments. Because the fine-tuning, the precision which experimentalists sitting at a high scale would need to achieve would depend, would grow very quickly if you increase the hierarchy, the size of the hierarchy. So you must have heard about several ways, several proposed solutions to this puzzle, to this hierarchy problem. And typically one considers solutions which involve a new symmetry. So you can try to, so as I said, the dangerous operators are the operators which are singlets under the symmetry, so this Higgs squared operator. If you try to invent a symmetry, if you try to extend your theory such that in the new theory this is not going to be longer a singlet operator, it's going to transform and trivial under the symmetry, then you can control away the hierarchy problem. And you know, there are some examples. There's a supersymmetry, you surely have heard, and there are some examples based on shift symmetries. But that's not what I would like to talk about today. So these solutions are based on symmetries, and what I would like to talk about is a solution based on dynamics. So imagine that the following thing is true. At energies, so the problem is in the Higgs sector of the standard model. So imagine that at energies much bigger than the TV, at the TV bigger, the Higgs sector actually changes behavior qualitatively. It becomes a strongly coupled conformal field theory. Well, we don't know why it does that. You know, there should be some new interactions responsible for that, for which we don't have any clue at the moment because we sit at low energy. But let's make this assumption. So, of course, this should not be just an arbitrary, strongly coupled conformal field theory. It should satisfy some constraints to be useful. What are these constraints? The first constraint is that you have to assume that in this new theory, the Higgs operator squared is no longer has dimension 2, but has dimension above 4. So it changes dimension by a lot. It really has an interaction is strong, so it acquires an anomalous dimension, which is big, and it pushes the dimension of Higgs squared to above 4. But what does it do for you? Well, in the new theory, there is no hierarchy problem. Because this operator Higgs squared was the troublesome repulsive operator. It's no longer repulsive. It became attractive. But, okay, if that were the case, it would be very easy to solve the hierarchy problem. Unfortunately, it's not the case. There is one more condition that you need to satisfy, and it is forced on you by phenomenology. It's forced on you by everything that we have learned about the Kabibu-Kobayashi-Maskawa structure of the standard model and all the phenomenology of flavor transitions. So the fact that they're all faithfully described by CKM matrix in the standard model, this fact, we have to live up to this experimental fact. Well, it turns out that the way not to destroy this beautiful agreement with experiment in flavor physics is to assume that the Higgs field itself, so the Higgs field squared had a big anomalous dimension, so it was pushed above 4, but couldn't it happen that the Higgs field itself had a relatively small anomalous dimension, so that its dimension would actually stay close, remain close to the free dimension, which is 1. You see, for this to happen, you have to have a large violation of factorization of operator dimensions, a very large violation, actually bigger than what happens in the three-dimensional easing model. So why, if you assume that this happens, if you assume that the dimension of H is close to one, then the Yukawa couplings, so that they have schematically the form Fermion bilinear operator times the Higgs field, this Ys, they remain almost nearly dimensionless. And you can show that this basically translates to improved behavior, to the fact that there are going to be no dangerous new effects that would violate the agreement of the standard model in the physics, in the flavor physics. Well, how close, close to one? Well, this depends on assumptions that you make about what actually assumptions that you make about the theory of flavor in the new theory. But if you make like the most pessimistic assumption about the theory of flavor, if you don't want, if you want to be as generic as possible, then it seems that less than 1.3 would be okay, would really be okay. So that's something that we could shoot for. Do we know of such a conformal theory? Well, unfortunately not. We don't know. But this is not surprising because we in general know very little about conformal field theories in higher dimensions. We learned a lot using ADS-CFT, but as I explained, in ADS-CFT, all the models that ADS-CFT produced for us, they manifestly do not satisfy the request that we need, that you can never hope to produce H being close to 1 and H squared being above 4. Okay, so, but do we know of any reason that such guy, such beast cannot exist? Maybe there is some deep reason that, you know, that this thing, this is pretty strange after all, you know, big dimensions, anomalous dimensions here, small there. It's a tall order, right? So there should be some reason, there should be some constraining reason that, which makes it difficult for these theories to exist. Is there such reason? And that's something that I would like to talk in the remaining 15 minutes. So this reason is goes under the name of crossing symmetry constraints. So what do I mean by that, by crossing symmetry? So crossing symmetry, it's in a weakly coupled field theory with which I'm sure everyone is familiar, crossing symmetry is manifest because if you work in a weakly coupled field theory, so you do things by summing Feynman diagrams, and then, okay, you compute the scattering amplitude, and then you sum the Feynman diagrams in the S channel and in the T channel, and then the very fact that you include both of these diagrams, it means that you can read the diagrams horizontally or you can read them vertically, and then this just interchanges the two diagrams, and this is the crossing symmetry. So this is manifestly true in weakly coupled. Now, if you go to strongly coupled theories, to conformal field theory, then the story becomes more complicated. So there is no such thing as Feynman diagrams, not generally. There is no general such thing as Feynman diagrams, but there is something which at least morally gives rise to very similar looking pictures. And this is called conformal block expansion. So that's the hair by which we pull. What it tells you is that if you want to compute a four-point correlation function in the CFT, then you have to sum, there is a way to organize an expansion of this four-point correlation function into all operators which are exchanged in the S channel. And the objects that you sum are called conformal blocks. So these objects are known. And the crucial difference from weakly coupled field theory is that now the crossing symmetry is not manifest. So you see here the prescription is that you only do the sum in the S channel, and you could equally do the sum in the T channel, but now you don't sum both things. Instead, you impose that this sum in the S channel has to be equal to the sum in the T channel. That's the condition that you impose, and this is the crossing symmetry. This is this crossing symmetry constraint. So, you know, in conformal field theory, you know, the way it works is that, you know, the way you compute these guys is that you can say fuse, as I explained, you can fuse this correlator, you can fuse these points, say these two points you can fuse them, and these two points you can fuse them, and then you can analyze the short distance singularity, short distance expansion of this correlator, and then you can analytically continue to an arbitrary separation. That's the way you do it. And, you know, so that this equation has to be valid at any separation of the points. You know, you don't have to assume anything about where the points are. So as such, it's a functional equation. It's really a functional equation. It's an infinite number of equations, essentially. And this, so what are the variables in this equation? These variables is what we call CFT data. So these variables are the dimensions and spins of operators that you exchange, and the couplings. So there is a way to parameterize these couplings, and they enter, obviously, every term is multiplied by the coupling squared in this expansion. So these are the variables that enter into this equation. And now the bootstrap, so this thing for which we started, the bootstrap hypothesis, it says that this equation is so strong that it should be enough to fix for you the CFT data uniquely or up to discrete number of possibilities. So this brave hypothesis was made back in 1974 by Polyakov. Well, the next thing I was going to say is that really we don't know much. So it has been proposed 30 years ago, but all ads are... I mean, in some special cases, yes, you're right, but... With supersymmetry, yeah, the supersymmetry there are modular, but you know, without supersymmetry, we think that generically there would be no modular. At least two dimensions. Now I'm talking about high dimensions. So, but you're right, you're right. So the point is that we don't really know, right? So this was proposed 30 years ago, but. This is very strong. This is very strong, and we did not really accumulate much evidence for the validity of this conjecture. Well, but they are going to be effective CFT. Well, it's not totally true because it's well known that if you put this in the grinder, then at high dimensions, at high operator dimensions, some things will go wrong. You know, you will encounter some coefficients which are imaginary and things like that. So, it's not true what you're saying. So, because it's an effect. So, the grinder gives you an effective CFT, and this is true only if it's an exact CFT, a complete CFT. Well, I'm imposing constraints of unitarity also, but I mean, you know very well, right? These coefficients cannot be arbitrary; they have to be positive, and so there is this equation. And okay, as you see, there is some disagreement even with my colleagues. So that's why we are here, right? We are in this workshop, but so as I said, there was not much evidence accumulated. About this conjecture, and it was basically lying dormant. Okay, there were some applications. I should not say that there was no not at all any application of this conjecture. Some specific cases were considered. But, you know, personally for me, I started, you know, taking this conjecture more seriously when we obtained this result. So what we basically managed to do with Riccardo Rattazzi, Eric Tonni, and Alessandro Vicky back in 2008, and then in a series of papers that followed, is that we managed to apply this bootstrap equation to learn something, to constrain this problem of conformal technicolor, which I explained. So what we have showed is that if you start here at this point when the dimension of the Higgs field is 1 and the dimension of the Higgs field squared equals to 2, and you start increasing the dimension of H gradually, then you can show that the dimension of H squared cannot be arbitrary. You can show that the dimension of H squared is necessarily must lie above a certain curve, which is a monotonic curve. And this curve crosses 4, which is the value needed to satisfy the absence of repulsive operators at the value of dimension of H equal about 1.1. So that's something that we learned. So what this means is that there exists this range from 1.1 to 1.3, which is an allowed range for conformal technicolor scenario. So you see, I said that for flavor reasons, the dimension of H cannot be bigger than 1.3, but you see that there is a certain range of dimensions where H, dagger H, can be above 4, and dimension of H can be less than 1.3. So that's something that we obtained. Well, we also obtained bounds on the dimensions of other operators which can appear in the OPE, which are much stronger bounds, but these operators are not singlets. They transform under the global symmetry group of the CFT, which is in this case a non-abelian symmetry SO4. So these operators are not relevant as far as the solution of the hierarchy problem is concerned, but what this graph tells you is that there are some, so we are learning something about the consistency conditions of the theory. What we are learning from this graph is that there are some operators which are more important for consistency of the theories. For instance, this operator, and the operator like H dagger H seems to be less important for the consistency of the theory, so it can be allowed to decouple. So we learn things like that. So, you see, this is an interesting phenomenological hint for potential relevance of conformal technicolor scenario in particle physics. Okay, this is something that should be eventually settled with the help of experiment and so on. But what I would like to emphasize is the theoretical importance of this result. So because, you know, what is really amazing is that how general this is. So we basically did not have to make any assumption whatsoever about our CFT. We could allow an arbitrary number of operators exchanged with arbitrary couplings, as long as they were unitary. And still, we managed to extract some, you see, generic constraints. So this is something which puts this kind of result on par with the result by Hellermann, which I reviewed before about the dimensions of black hole operators. And, you know, this just, you know, tells you that it works. You can do something with it. So, where do we go from here? You know, physics demands that we should invest brain power into this question about high dimensional CFTs, and we will do. ADS CFT has been a good friend. It has given us a lot of insights, and it will surely give more insights. But you see, for certain phenomenological applications, it's not enough. And also, there is a feeling that, you know, since it's been around for a long time, we already learned, as far as phenomenology is concerned, we extracted a big portion of its potential. We know what to expect. It's time to move on, as far as phenomenology is concerned. And recently, there was a proliferation of all these general results about CFTs, which were not based on any ADS interpretation, just followed from prime principles. And surely, there are more results hiding there, waiting to be discovered. And so, my slogan for today is forward to the bootstrap.
Questions? Are there questions from the students?
So I'm curious. So when you mentioned the 3D Ising model, and you were quite confident that that was on one side of the line, basically because it had low dimension operators, I guess.
For various reasons, yeah.
Yeah. So just to take another real world example, like the transition to the quark gluon plasma, which side of the line would you put that on?
Well, I don't know, because we don't know really. There's no data about critical exponents of that transition, and
no real world.
I would have to look at the data and make a statement. But the situation in that case is potentially better. Because we know that it's QCD, and large N expansion works in many cases well in QCD. So there is a reason to expect that in that case, Gaussian approximation could be. I don't know. I think it's a first order transition. Actually, it's a crossover. So, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, just a small remark about terminology. You, at some moment, you started to speak about effective theory. Well, this may be within the framework you were doing, but the only theories I know are effective. There's no theory which I consider as a complete theory, neither do I have ever the opinion we could reach it. We can always describe certain parts of nature and maybe a bit better, have a somewhat better theory. Quantum mechanics is very strong, but I cannot I cannot see this in no way ever as a complete theory. So, a small slight remark.
What you are saying is only partly true. Mostly I agree with you, but CFTs are different beasts. So CFT is, if you take an Ising model at the critical point, this is a universal quantum mechanical system, which is well defined without knowledge of microscopic structure. Whatever microscopic structure leads to the same universality class, it's the same thing, the same correlators, the same critical exponents. So that is a complete theory in this subsector. It's okay, but it applies for a given set of experiments with arbitrary precisions.
Okay. There's a class of critical phenomena in nature which are driven, non-equilibrium-driven critical phenomena, or so-called self-organized critical phenomena, which are scale-invariant classical statistical mechanical phenomena. Are these outside your classification? I'm thinking about things like directed percolation or the sand pile model, or Bach, etc.
Percolation models are described by conformal field theories. Directed percolation, I have no idea what this is. Sorry. Yeah, so there is this interesting comment that perhaps I should make, that in statistical mechanics, the amount of models that you're allowed to consider is much bigger than in particle physics. So, for instance, in particle physics, we want to have unitary quantum mechanical systems, and it's not true that any statistical mechanical model with a well-defined positive definite Hamiltonian is going to give rise to a quantum mechanical unitary model upon weak rotation. So in statistical mechanics, you see lots of people talk freely about non-unitary conformal field theories, and they use them to do many useful things. So for particle physics applications, we can restrict to a smaller class. Yeah.
You mentioned at the beginning that you had some examples of critical points which satisfied scale invariants but not special transformations.
Yeah.
Can you mention what those ones are?
Well, the simplest physically relevant example is the theory of elasticity in 2 and 3 dimensions, which is the same as a vector field without gauge invariance if you weak rotate it to the Minkowski space.
But this is a classical theory. This is no fluctuation.
It's free theory.
So they are.
It's well defined quantum mechanically.
Are they all free theories?
I think not. But this question has not been studied deeply.
But the part of the reason for the thing is you only needed scale invariants, it looked like, for your extensions beyond the standard model.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
For your hierarchy problem, you looked like you only needed scale invariants rather than full conformal invariants. So are you demanding too much?
This is true. Yeah, this is true that a priori I only need scale invariants. But it's particularly in particle physics. So if under the assumption of unitarity, there is an even bigger body of evidence that scale invariance implies conformal invariance. So, you know, granted this small theorem, which so far we have not managed to prove, I was not losing any generality.
So...
Speaking about hierarchy, if you go to the neutrino sector, these masses are pretty small. At best, electron volt, and most people think they are even much below. So your gap is huge. Would your ideas have any statement on this?
That's a very good question. There is a neat answer to it. Because the neutrino masses are described in the standard model by... So there are operators of three kinds. There are repulsive operators. On technical language, they're called relevant operators. There are marginal operators, and there are irrelevant operators, the ones which are driven very quickly to zero as you approach the fixed point. Now, the neutrino masses are described by operators which are irrelevant. So it's very natural. It's not at all an accident. It's a very natural thing that we observe them to be so small. It completely agrees with the effective field theory interpretation of everything.
So you could predict them?
No, because you don't know where you start the flow. If you knew that, you could predict them, yeah.
Any more questions? So if not, we resume the program. We will have a more technical discussion of exactly this bound by Hatasi, and let's thank Slava.